Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I am the conscience of psychiatry. It's so sad to think of how few other consciences there are within psychiatry itself. There are many outside. My guest today, hang on for my guest today, is going to be extraordinarily interesting. He's a conscience in psychology, but in the medical group, in the shrinks, in the psychiatrists, I am, for better or worse, the conscience of psychiatry. And times are changing. Times are changing. I just came back from Los Angeles, where I spoke at an annual military stress conference run by my friend, psychologist, retired military officer, Bart Billings. And from colonels and majors to just plain old hardworking healthcare providers, psychologists, social workers, family and marriage therapists, all in the armed services, I got a very warm welcome and a very interesting experience. Even in the Army, in an organization you'd think people wouldn't want to take a stand, there is a growing awareness that the drugging of our troops, the massive drugging of our troops, the ones who are going into battle are being drugged. The lowest estimate I heard of the number of soldiers on active duty in war zones on drugs was 20 to 30%. That's the lowest estimate I got. Some people were saying in their experience, it's just about everybody is on a psychiatric drug. And I'm getting calls from soldiers saying they're trying to put me on drugs before they'll let me go into combat. So now being on an antidepressant or an antipsychotic drug or a stimulant or a benzo is a requirement for going into action, when before the Iraq War, before the pharmaceutical industry got so powerful in the Army, you couldn't go into action on a psychiatric drug. So times are changing. Psychiatry is getting worse and worse. But the vast majority of Americans, everywhere I go, are more and more aware that there's something desperately wrong with this system. And they're more and more talking about empathy. They're more and more talking about caring. They're more and more seeing that what really matters between human beings are open, caring, meaningful relationships. Whether you're talking about a marriage, whether you're talking about therapy, whether you're talking about being an activist. Wow, it really is changing out there. Apropos of that, my new book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it will be out in a couple of months, and you can get advanced copies on Bragan.com. We're giving a discount. It's a medical book. We can't discount it much. It's not what's called a trade book or a popular book. But I've written it so that not just prescribers, but therapists, patients, and their families can benefit from this new approach. It's time to have a collaborative approach to treatment, not just somebody giving out pills, but we need the involvement of therapists, patients, and families in the decision-making process. At this conference, I met Stanley Krippner for the first time. He is a grand person from the origins of humanistic psychology. Stanley Krippner, and he, I'm proud to say, is now a member of the advisory council of our Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. And I met a wonderful woman, Chris Ann Gordon, who's a physician and is working with head injury patients and who believes in the empathic non-medication approach and who is just a terrific, terrific person to be working with. again, I just feel like it's time for people to realize we are getting together. My wife, Ginger Breggin, is working with my guest, Michael Cornwall, and I understand we temporarily lost a connection to Michael. We'll hope to get him back. Well, this will be an even more interesting show as I freelance it for you on whatever is on my mind, which is not a bad thing. I think, in fact, I know what I'll do. So we'll see if we can get Michael back. But Michael is a psychologist who's been working in this field for 30 years, and he's a part of two groups that are really coming to the fore right now. For one thing, he's a designated blogger. He blogs officially on Robert Whitaker's Mad in America. And Whitaker is doing a lot of good work. And Bob will be here on my show on June 4th. I really, really look forward to that. And Michael is also a part of the Mother Bear Community Action Network. This is a new organization that is in many ways an alternative to NAMI, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill. Let me tell you how much this goes around. And Michael is back and is connected. And I just want to tell you, Michael, I've been talking a little bit about you and how you're a part of this whole new resurgence that is going on. So Michael's a part of Whitaker's Mad in America. And I was telling folks that Whitaker's going to be on my show on June 4th. I'm really looking forward to that. And a part of the Mother Bear Community Action Network. And he's on their advisory council. I think that's what it's called. And my wife Ginger is on that council. We are integrating the various aspects of this movement are integrating. So let me welcome to the show my friend who is going to be a better and better friend, Michael Cornwall, PhD. Hi. Are you solidly connected?
I'm solidly here, and thank you, Peter. It's so wonderful to be here. And we've been talking about things changing so dramatically, and I just wanted to say that a lot of people are seeing this big wave of change coming. And for some of us who've been around for a long time, we know that there's no one who's done more than you have to help create it. So a lot of people are standing on your shoulders right now and don't know it.
Thank you for that, Michael. Now, you were doing stuff before I had shoulders to stand on, or pretty much about the same time. You go back 30 years. So start anywhere you want and talk about what you've been doing, what you see happening.
Okay, well, yes, I started working in the field about 1980 as a therapist.
Well, I've been around a while by then.
I know you had this. So,
did you read any of my books way back then? I hadn't written a lot.
I hadn't way back then. The first one I read was Toxic Psychiatry, and it was more than a breath of fresh air for those of us who were in the anti-psychiatry movement and were radical therapists. It was like, finally, there's something here that we can hold on to that, in a way, legitimizes a lot of what we were feeling and saying. But I know you were writing things back in the 70s. It's amazing.
Well, go ahead now and you know, talk about, I think what's going to be really interesting is your views on helping deeply disturbed persons, as well as how NAMI and other organizations have fought against these moves. They fought against me way, way back, and how Mother Bear is a community action network is an answer that's more really family-oriented. I'm going to give the mic to you now.
Okay, I'll try and tie all that together some. Let me start at the beginning for me, which really was way back when I was a young man, about 20 years old. I went through a madness, psychotic experience. I was pretty isolated at the time. It was during the Vietnam era, and I was against the war. Most of my friends were really into going to war and stuff, and so I was pretty isolated, you know, a typical alienated young man, a good-hearted person. I was in pre-med school and stuff, but I was doing a lot of drugs, and at one time took some LSD that really set me off down a real year of hell, of madness, and I was fortunate to have a sanctuary to be in. My grandmother, who was in her late 80s, was pretty senile. She didn't really know what day it was, but her love for me was unconditional. So I was able to stay there. My folks were on the East Coast, and I was in a small northwestern town. So for months, I went through this process without medication, without psychiatric help. I really knew, Peter, in my in my cells, that I didn't want to get anywhere near the psychiatric establishment there, that in your wonderful introduction in Toxic Psychiatry, you talk about madness and so-called schizophrenia and all the different dimensions of it, the spiritual, the soul, the mysterious, the family, the cultural, and all that kind of hit me. So the narrow explanation that I had some kind of brain disease just never spoke to me. I mean, you'd think if someone was suffering, they would go to the doctor. Well, when you know going to the doctor is the worst thing to do, that says something. Anyway, I went through that and came out the other side, and it really set the course for my vocation. So then I was on my way to becoming an Episcopal priest, and my spiritual advisor advised me against that, said I was too rebellious, so I ended up coming to the Bay Area here and starting in a program, and ended up working in this place called iWard, which was a freestanding 20-bed, no restraints, we used no diagnosis, no medication facility for people in early psychosis.
Go ahead. Just tell us about what that
okay.
was about.
I'll keep going.
I'll just give you a little nudge along the way because you've got a lot to tell folks.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think it's important for folks to know that there's been a systematic, not only blocking of innovative, heart-centered approaches to madness and every other kind of human emotional suffering, but there's been a real revision of history, as you know, around a lot of the things that have been good. Back in the 1960s, Esalen Institute here on the West Coast, some people may have heard of it, it's a real leader in the whole human potential movement. Abraham Maslow and a lot of the leaders were there. Richard Price, who had been the co-founder of Esalen, had been through his own travails of being locked up and given shock treatment and everything. So they wanted to look at how people could be treated more humanely than was being done by psychiatry. So they started this project at the Agnew State Hospital in Northern California, funded by the NIMH. And most people have never heard of this Agnew's project, although I was at a conference just a couple weeks ago where Bob Whitaker cites it. That's how good it was. It was a double blind study where a large group, about 50 in each, of young men who were actively psychotic in their first experience, one got medication, Thorazine, one got placebo, and at a three-year follow-up, the people who got the placebo had a 75% lower rehospitalization rate. So there was this remarkable efficacy result from people going through this milieu therapy there where compassion and the whole design was to help people connect and have a real connection with another human being. Well, the people who got the Thorazine had a really bad long-term result. So from that, in the Bay Area, there was kind of this mecca of these programs. Then iWard, where I was at, was open for 8 years. 20 people, no diagnosis, no restraints. We didn't even test people. That's why a lot of people never heard of it. We didn't feel it was humane to put people through the whole process of giving them all the assessments and stuff. So anyway, our results and John Perry's Diabetes House and Lauren Mosier's that was in San Jose, all about the same as we're seeing now from the Open Dialogue people in Finland. About a 75% of people who get what they need in the front end don't end up to be in the system. To me, it's like a crime that isn't available to people now.
It's a crime against humanity. It's an atrocity. Psychiatry is destroying brains and shortening lives. It's a terrible, terrible thing that's going on, Michael. So just, you know, go on and talk some more about what you think madness is about.
Okay, well, I don't think anyone can find a better look at that than in the beginning of your book on Talk to Psychiatry, where you talk about so-called schizophrenia. Because from my own experience and then witnessing so many people go through it, it's really, as you know, a complex, very mysterious in ways, human process. It's been going on since the beginning of our species. The Greeks wrote about divine madness. It was been viewed in very many different ways as demon possession. And then there was the whole asylum movement during the 1700s and 1800s where people were basically just locked up and forgotten. I reading in Toxic Psychiatry about your first encounter at a mental institution where people were just in these awful, almost prison-like environments. Well, to me, that whole kind of cultural response to madness often defines how it is viewed. There's, you know, different cultures see someone who's going through one of these experiences as possibly a visionary or a shamanic person or a healer. But working as a therapist in the United States, I saw that on iWard we were mostly seeing it as a process that a person is going through with all these different levels, the cultural, the spiritual, the interpersonal, and a large part of it happening, you know, as people move into young adulthood. So it's kind of that glass ceiling of young adulthood. We called it like a leaving home madness process, where people who were sensitive, who had been traumatized, or just in many different ways were not equipped to make the developmental step into young adulthood, had to go through this transformative, I think it's potentially like a birth process. It was for me. And those people we saw in iWard came in, they were in these full-blown, very dramatic psychotic processes. And you think about it, Peter, to have 20 people, not all that were active that at the same time, but at least a half dozen. I mean, a lot of reason why psychiatry wants to dampen people who are in that place, it's very powerful. But they went through their process and came out the other side and were able to move on. So if that process gets aborted in the birth canal of development, then the person's stuck there. I think that accounts for the revolving door where then, as life goes on, when person's on medication, if a major stressor happens or if they go off their medication, they're kind of right back where they started because they haven't been able to go through the birth canal out into adult life. But we could talk about, you know, all the different nuanced causes and meanings of madness for a long time. And I think that's something that's incumbent on the consumer survivor movement to get more clear on if madness isn't what biopsychiatry says it is, then what is it? You know, until we can answer a first-year psychiatric resident who can, you know, tell us in 3 to 5 minutes what madness is, and until we have a really viable alternate definition, I think we're kind of at the mercy of them telling us what goes on.
Well, tell me about what you're working toward as your definition, if I can. I don't mean to put you on the spot,
no,
but just to have a conversation.
Sure.
Let's talk a little about that.
Well, I think because most people have their first madness experience when they are in that leaving home situation, I mean, kind of like going into young adulthood. So on iWard, we had people, some who were like their freshman year at Stanford and they had their breakdown, or their first cruise in the Navy, or their first love affair, their first going away to college, or their first job. So there's this. To me, it seems ridiculous that people would say there's this biological ticking time bomb that waits for this person who's been through grade school, been through high school. You know, has one person I worked with had a job, had an athletic scholarship, had a girlfriend, had a car, everything. And then there was a big thing that happened that in his life where he had to give that up because his parents demanded it. Well, all the affect that came up, I really think madness and most everything we encounter as therapists has to do with emotion. How do we integrate? How do we hold, name, express these powerful emotions that come up? So for this young man, when he was like told, you need to come home and give all that up because we found out that your brother is gay and you need to come make him not gay. I mean, that's like an untenable situation, right? So he came home, and within a couple of weeks, he was psychotic. All those emotions that he couldn't hold, the rage, the disappointment, the fear, all that, I think that's how kind of mechanically it happens around the emotions. When people can't experience and express their emotions, we go into these kind of metaphorical worlds to give meaning to that affect, to that emotion that's going on. But that
I think that's, I think that's really, really key for me, is the metaphorical world. I'm really in no way contradicting anything you're saying, because I think that we build this from a lot of viewpoints.
Yeah.
One of the ways I start looking at it is, who is the person who goes mad? Well, first of all, it's not an insensitive dope who goes mad.
No.
People who go mad are very sensitive. They tend to be very aware. They tend to be very reactive and on some level in touch with all the conflicted emotions in the world around them.
Yeah.
For another thing, they tend to be metaphorical. They tend to be people who think in creative terms about their lives, often spiritual terms, often a sense of God, often issues around identity of who they are going to be and the identities of their parents and what they think is confused about it.
Yeah.
So they're people who are really involved in a poetic, creative way. And if they're not those kind of people, then what they go through gets labeled OCD or depression or something else. But in many ways, I see the people who end up with hallucinating or deluded or in some other way seeming far out to us, I see them as broken poets. I see them as struggling with the meaning of their lives, and it's breaking down. They're trying to find their way through it, and they need to reconstruct with all of that amazing creativity that went into the breakdown and being diagnosed and told they're schizophrenic stops that process, or being told they're bipolar and they're having a manic episode, or being told or being put on drugs stops that process. So we are looking at people who have, without glamorizing madness, they have very special, creative, intuitive issues and identity issues that they're struggling with. They lose their grip because who they were brought up to be is not meshing with who they really are or how they're going to deal with the world. And when they come apart, it looks crazy because they're so full of life. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's absolutely the way I see it, too. And all that you're saying there points to seeing the process as a transformative process. If it's greeted and held in the way where it is allowed to go through where it needs to go. So the underlying thing that we did was be with people in a receptive, loving, non-linear way. And many years ago, I did a co-led a workshop with Lauren Mosier, you know, from Soteria, and a young man, Matt Morrissey, who had been at Birch House. I don't remember Birch House. It was kind of a Lang-In place in back east. Anyway, we all agreed that the necessary and sufficient conditions when someone is going through a process like that is to be received in a very open, human-hearted, even, I'm using the word loving these days. I remember now you used the word love back in 1990 and probably before. It's like
I used it in a book we wrote about the volunteer program in the state mental hospital that I worked in college. I don't know where I got it from.
No,
but
I saw
I was talking about love back in 1955 and 6. Yeah.
I saw that. In fact, I'm going to read the quote right here. It says, "You must at all times aim at giving support and love to the patient. Make him feel that he is important to you, the worker. This must be the most important goal of all relationships." I mean, that's it right there. So the psyche, the soul, this person who is in this transformative process, if they're given that, and that's what we gave, that's what Soteri Iward gave, then things work. The psyche has a partner. It's necessary. I went through this process that I did. My grandmother was there. She was very loving. I would go to her at times when I was in the worst of it, just in these terrible disembodied states and stuff, and I'd say, "Grandma, would you put your hand on my forehead?" You know, like when I was a little boy.
And she'd
She'd put her hand there, and she'd go, "There, there, Michael, you must have the flu." You know, "No, honey, I don't have the flu. I don't know what's going on." But that human heart-centered response is what brings people through. So it is kind of like being midwives when we help people.
Wow. Now, one of the things that makes me think about is one of the reasons we need these institutional approaches where people can be in a safe place is that so often the madness is in part a response to the intolerable conflicting messages from the family about the person. Literally, there may be messages that, you know, you should have been aborted and don't deserve to live, or they could just be very conflicting messages, or just a lack of love, whatever. It could be many, many different things. It could be an ordinary a family with this extraordinary spiritual being in their midst. It could be so many different things that bring about this crisis. And so it's very hard to work inside some of these families as an outpatient, like I tried to do. It sometimes just isn't going to work very well because the person is struggling right within the family. And that's where we need to be able to have a place for the person to go. That's where the kind of inpatient work that you were doing is so critical. We've got about a minute or two before break, and I'll let you know when we hit break. Did you ever try this work, Michael Cornwall, as an outpatient, as a psychologist in an office?
Yes, I did. After the sanctuaries closed under the heel of the growing psychiatry movement, I carried my same philosophy and approaches out into the community and found that the same heart-centered approach working with people over time, some people who were on medication, some people who weren't able to avail themselves of the sanctuary experience, that over time, and this was what was controversial, I would do dream work with people and kind of jump-start that affective imagery emotion engine down there, and I would see remarkable results with Peter over time who had been in the system. So it's possible. Madness to me, no matter where you are, whether it's the first time or 20 years later and you're still having it, you still deserve someone to be there with you and open themselves to your inner experience. And I'd like to talk about that maybe a little bit after the break.
Yeah, we'll go to break, and I'm talking with Michael Cornwall, and we are going to continue what I hope is one of the more interesting conversations about madness and its transformation.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and my marvelous guest is Michael Cornwall, PhD. Michael is many different things, and among them, he is a blogger on Robert Whittaker's Mad in America. And Michael, how can people get in touch with you?
They can get in touch with me through Mad in America, but I would welcome anyone emailing me at michael.cornwall@att.net. michael.cornwall@att.net.
Great. We are talking about, and I think, Michael, I'd just like to stay on the madness issue and have you back another time and talk about the history of the unfolding of the catastrophe we're now in and the suppression of the better alternatives.
Yes.
We haven't had a show that really delved this much into what is madness. One of the things that I think resonates with what you're saying is that an aspect of madness is that an individual finds themselves and their identity so humiliated and confused and threatened in the world they're in that they withdraw from human beings. They lose all trust, faith, and hope in their ability to have a human relationship. And so they go into the air, into the region of dream and withdrawal and shame and humiliation and anger and feel that there's no hope. And that's where one person can make such a difference. Even in the first hour, even in the first hour, you can make such a difference if you're a person who meets this other person where they are, talks with them respectfully and courteously and caringly about what they're going through, not affirming that their voices are real, not in my approach, not affirming that their delusions are real, but affirming that their experience is very, very real and wanting to understand it, wanting to be there with them. And one of the things I do in my office when someone comes in, within the first 10 minutes, I say to them, by the way, it's safe here. I don't diagnose people and I don't drug people and I don't put people in hospitals against their will. No diagnoses, no drugging, no involuntary treatment. You're safe. And I right away try to establish that we're here to be together and not for me to control you. And it works wonders with the most disturbed people. Over to you, Michael.
Well, that's so beautiful. I just found myself, I don't know, laughing for some reason, just like, you know, if someone's actually doing it. I mean, it's, you know, it's like, my God. That's it. I mean, in essence, you're creating a sanctuary there. You're creating a safe place where this person can come with all those dangers not facing them. You're not going to diagnose them, label them, and take away their hope. You're not going to medicate them and take away their emotions. And, you know, we're exquisitely sensitive beings. People respond to when they feel safe, especially when they're in that level of distress. On iWard, within 20 minutes of someone entering our system, this was a public mental health system that was funded by Medi-Cal and Medicaid. I mean, this was kind of like a pirate ship existing in this sea of psychiatry, but we would go down to the psych emergency within 10 or 15 minutes of someone being identified as being in a psychotic process, and they would immediately be brought up to that sanctuary. And these were people who, some of them had been running down the streets naked in their neighborhoods. As soon as they got in that sanctuary, like, they're, I know they're feeling your office, there was this, you know, okay. There was this feeling of acceptance, and even though they were still really mad, you'd think, well, you have an open door. You must have been chasing people all the time. No, people knew where they wanted to be. Once in a while, someone would run off, and 99% of the time, they would come back. We would, you know. So it's like we know when we're getting what we need, and that empathic, loving receptivity is really the key, whether someone is in their first episode, or I'm sure you see people who have been in the system, some on meds, some off. That was my experience too.
You know, people say, well, what would you do without involuntary treatment? And I say, first, there's no evidence it ever helped anybody. It's been around for hundreds of years. There's not a single study showing a good outcome from involuntary treatment. What you do is you just intimidate and humiliate people further. And if you don't have involuntary treatment, then people will be willing to come for help. And as in your case you're describing, if they run away, they might just come back. And they will get help because they'll feel it's under their own steam. People don't respond well to being bullied and intimidated and humiliated. They tend to fight back. Now, there's a myth about how violent all these people are. I'll bet there was very little, if any, violence in your settings.
There wasn't direct. No, there wasn't. There wasn't, like, direct assaults on other people.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
There wasn't. Sometimes someone would get really agitated and would be making threatening gestures or, like, throwing stuff around. And we, this is what I was hoping we would talk about next, is people would always ask, well, what happens if someone gets violent or is dangerous? We had a room, a safe room, where someone, we would go in with them if they were out of control, and we would hold them. Sometimes it would take three or four of us to hold the person, again, lovingly, like you would be holding your child if they were having some kind of really hard time, like a convulsion or something, and we would hold them lovingly, Peter, and I swear, every single time, it was a breakthrough in the person's therapeutic process, because after sometimes an hour or maybe an hour and a half of them screaming and flailing and being held lovingly, not punitively, they would start to kind of wind down and sob a little bit and become, you know, like cuddle in like a child would after they'd been through a scary thing. So containing them with love, even when they were out of control physically, is totally possible.
Well, you know, in my experience, working 4 years as a college student deep into the violent wards of Metropolitan State Hospital, then 3.5 years on psychiatric wards, only on one occasion did one of my patients become violent to me. Yeah. And it was somebody I hadn't met yet. And
right.
He'd been interviewed by somebody else on intake. This was at Harvard at the Mass Mental Health Center. And I'm sitting talking with a patient in my little office, and there's a knock on the door, and I go to the door, and this 17-year-old hauls off and smacks me in the jaw, mm-hmm. right in front of the other patient. Then he turned around and left. I closed the door. I didn't even go after him, like almost any of the other residents would have. I just sat and tried to help my patient I was working with get through all of this, and this was pretty scary. Now, on this ward, the alternatives that the other Harvard residents had in mind were you punish him, you put him on heavy restriction, you shock him, give him shock treatment. We had that happen when conflicts occurred. You drug him out of his mind. And I went and visited him, and I said to him, much to the dismay of everybody on the ward, I said to him, you can't hit people who are trying to help you. I'm going to discharge you. So you just have to go now, and you think about whether you want people to help you.
Uh-huh.
Well, there was an uproar, but the head of the ward, who really understood my work, which was a blessing, not the chief resident, who was just another henchman, but the very subtle, now gone, John Mack, who became a fairly famous guy afterward. John understood what I was doing. And we got a call later from his mother. She said, I can't believe it. I came home. My son was on the doorstep crying.
Yeah.
She said, and thank you for what you did. He's been a different person. Thank you for what you did. Now, ordinary psychiatry would have made his punch in my jaw look like nothing compared to how they would assault this young man under those conditions.
Right.
And instead, I dealt with him as I would anyone who would take a punch at me, which is, I'm not going to have anything to do with you. You know, you think this through and come back if you want later.
Yeah.
And that literally is the only time I've ever felt threatened by, certainly the only time I've ever been assaulted, including in the state mental hospitals. And the attitude I always brought was, I'm here love to be with you on the backwards of the hospital. Love to sit with you, but I'm not here to bother you. I'm not here to take advantage of you. And, you know, I'll hang around if you want. And that led to, in part, I think, in part, first I'm just lucky and blessed, but in part to the fact that none of my patients through all those years, through now, through a practice that's gone on for decades, has ever really hurt anybody while they've been working with me and has never killed themselves. I think, you know, you don't need to save people by drugging them. It doesn't work, and locking them up. The way you save people is you give them an opportunity if they want it. You give them an opportunity. Your thoughts, sir?
Well, that's the proof is in the pudding, you know. That's a huge span of years for you to have had that positive effect on people. And
I don't help everybody, Michael. I mean, the people I don't help are usually people who are coming from such distressed and dysfunctional families that the moment I'm actually helping the person, the family can't catch up with the equilibrium, and it becomes a real problem. And that's where it's better to have a more of an intervention system like they have in Finland, where, you know, they're having a few therapists going out and working with the families and working with the patients just as one unit. You know, in the Finnish program, the open dialogue, people can Google it as open dialogue program. They say schizophrenia is in between the people and the family.
Yeah,
and I don't have that resource. I haven't developed that resource, and I think I'd be more able to help families if I were doing that. Maybe in another lifetime.
Maybe in another lifetime, but as you say, when you help one person in a family, sometimes it really disturbs the equilibrium, and they get pulled back into all the patterns in the family that have caused them so many problems. Working with the family when it's possible, I think, is really crucial. And sometimes it's just not possible. In fact, Diabetes House that John Perry had in San Francisco, that was the kind of the Jungian, Carl Jung, you know, the psychiatrist who believed in the collective unconscious. I'm saying this for your listeners who may not know. They really didn't involve the families when people were going through their madness, and with about the same effect of some of the programs like iWard, where we did a lot of family therapy. So sometimes it's possible, especially in that first encounter, for someone to go through it, that healing process, because it is such an internally driven process, like a diabetes. And
well, if they're separated from the family,
exactly,
that's
separated
the key.
From the family, and I think it serves some people well.
No, I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does.
Some people will object to saying that, but I believe it. I've seen some families where there was so much pain, and I love family. There's no one in a family who doesn't deserve as much love and support as any other family members. But some families have been through so much trauma and are so wounding to each other that it's almost like a lifesaver for some people to get some distance.
Yes, absolutely. Michael, tell us something more about the Mother Bear Community Action Network. Is it the advisory council that you're on?
Well,
and
I'm on the...
And the Ginger's on? It's something like that. My wife, Ginger Bregan?
Yes, I'm on that, and I'm on kind of a smaller work group, too, that through the vision of my dear friend now, Elizabeth Reese of, you know, the wonderful Cooper Reese program in North Carolina, she had this vision that families needed more, and it was based on her experience. And so I got involved with them, so thankful to be part of this new Community Action Network. It's going to be, they have a website now, the Mother Bears Community Action Network, and it's going to be a presence, Peter, in every community, I believe. I think it may be the biggest kind of changing for the better organization come along in a long time. When I heard about it, I felt like if it had been available when I was seeing families every day for almost 30 years, I would have given every one of them a referral to it, because it's going to be in the community real-time support groups where, you know, we know NAMI has their support groups people can go to and get what NAMI has to offer. This has something I would say that is an addition to, and in contrast, actually, because it, the Mother Bear's vision is, they believe, in complete recovery from every form of so-called mental illness. So they don't believe that a diagnosis should be a life sentence or that people need to be on medications for their whole lives. So it's really a non-existent until now resource that's going to be providing education, support, and I think the crucial thing, a place where Dr. Cornwall here can give a referral to a mother whose 14-year-old son is tearing up the school and the house and can go and to that evening and go and meet with other mothers and other people and get support and hope. Hope, you know, like we've been talking about, is so important.
Tell us how people can most easily get in touch with the treatment program.
The treatment program isn't really a treatment program attached to the Mother Bears Network per se. It's going to be a clearinghouse and
How about the Cooper Reese? I mean, they have.
Okay. Yeah,
I don't mind just advertising them directly. Yeah. I mean, they if that's okay with you and them.
No, absolutely. I think they're probably, beyond a doubt, other than the Soteria House up in Anchorage, Alaska, as far as I know, they're the only place. Well, Windhorse, too, is another place. But Cooper Reese has been there for over 10 years now. They have incredible results helping people through madness processes and different kinds of distress. And it's in North Carolina. It's, I'm sorry, I don't have the website. But
well, people can find it, I'm sure.
It's Cooper Reese, Cooper Reese in North Carolina.
Super, super.
Yeah.
I am so glad to be indirectly involved with all of this through Ginger, and I want to just give total support to you, to the Mother Bear Community Action Network. I think there's a lot of hope here for a group that involves the family in the healing instead of diagnosing the one member of the family as crazy and in need of involuntary treatment, drugs, and lobotomy and shock treatment, all of which is supported by NAMI. At one time or another, they've supported all of those things. They're very big on involuntary treatment and on control. And I think it's just marvelous to be having a group coming through who says, now, the family is about healing, and it's all about getting really better and completely better and having a better life than ever, not becoming a chronic mental patient under the control of the family and organized psychiatry, which is the NAMI theme. So we're talking about black and white here, I think.
We really are. I mean, I know if Elizabeth is listening, which she might be, they're not wanting to compete with or challenge NAMI. I for one have seen NAMI be an incredibly, I would say, destructive force. This is just me speaking, not as a Mother Bears person, with their, I think it's 47 states now where they have the involuntary outpatient laws that would never would have happened if NAMI hadn't been the human face kind of pushed forward by psychiatry and big pharma to testify and to get the legislators to respond that way. On the other hand, I've worked for countless, many years with NAMI as head of a coalition where they were an active part, and many times with local NAMI people, I've stood on common ground and we've accomplished wonderful things. But I think the national NAMI agenda of basically adopting every untrue, in my opinion, tenet of biopsychiatry has been a disaster. And,
NAMI people sit on the board of the American Psychiatric Association. They're right there. I don't know if they're official board members, but they are right there at the meetings influencing. They are frequently right at the top of NIMH developing the programs and setting agendas. And it's all about whatever the pharmaceutical industry and the American Psychiatric Association are pushing. So, listen, I apologize if I've been making it too black and white and... It is my views, and I go back a long way. I didn't start out being against NAMI. They started out being against me. They actually brought an action against my medical license back in the 80s because of remarks I made on Oprah Winfrey in favor of caring, loving, non-drug approaches to treatment. They literally went after my medical license, which turned into, as almost every attack on me has turned into, probably one of the biggest opportunities of my life. We won the, completely won this attack on my freedom of speech, which they literally brought against my medical license. My wife was inspired to completely partner with me and to work totally with me ever since on these issues. Started out with her defending me with all her marvelous PR, educational, legal, all these vast skills she has across the board, brought them to bear on our work. And it led to a publisher saying, all right, this guy is somebody. He's a public figure, and he's saying new and unique things and being attacked. We'll publish Toxic Psychiatry. So maybe what I should say, which I've never said before, is thank you, NAMI. You brought me out of obscurity with your attack on me in the 1980s. And thank you, Ginger Breggin, because that's when you really partnered with me, and it's because of you that, Ginger, that we won that attack, and we've won so many others since then. So, and if NAMI ever wants to reach out to me in a positive direction, I would welcome them. Welcome them.
I know you would. Because, and well, it's wonderful to hear the unintended consequences of them trying to bury you.
Yes.
And you're not the only. You know, they try to do it with Lauren Mosier and other people too, and it's.
Of course.
I think people need to look at that mean-spirited way that you know, this juggernaut that you and I have been, you longer than me, been fighting against, of the biopsychiatry, big pharma, and must say NAMI too. I mean, it's been a steamroller. I mean, it is kind of the worst of days, and how bad it's gotten with little kids 3 years old being bipolar and on meds, and the soldiers on meds.
Yeah.
But there's this wave coming that I think it's going to really reverse things. I'm excited to be part of it.
Well, I think the way that we can put it into the best perspective is that on the one hand, you have the groups that are pushing with the pharmaceutical industry for lifelong diagnosing and drugging, which enriches psychiatrists, brings great power to organizations like CHAD and NAMI, and which is the opposite of empowering the patients to have full recovery with undamaged brains and minds to go on and live better lives than ever in their loving families or on their own. Michael Cornwall, bless you. Thank you for being on my show. Thank you for Mother Bear Community Action Network. I think times are changing, Michael. Say a quick goodbye to our audience.
I will say goodbye to everyone listening. And if Ginger, I think you're listening, thank you. You and Peter are a team. You're the power duo, and I can't say enough about what you guys have done for every one of the people I've tried to serve. Bless you forever.
Thank you, Michael Cornwall.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Breggin and his lifelong reform work on www.breggin.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.